Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Let me start today's meeting. We have intensive program today, starting with the briefing on IPv4, IPv6 transition from the NRO. We have distinguished representatives of three RERs with us, and after this session we will have discussion on amendment of Article 9 of our operating principles related to elections of the officers. Then Teresa will come to make a brief presentation on ICANN's strategic activities, which is related, or as a result, we will have a discussion on GAC work program for 2010, and after that we can continue our discussions on role of the GAC and institutional version of ICANN, depending on time. And we will break for the lunch at 12:30, and those delegations who will want at 12:30 will have .Asia folks coming in doing presentation on developments in .Asia, as well as share experience, their experience on treating geographic names and other questions of our interest. So, and then in the afternoon we will start our traditional drafting exercise, drafting of communique. All this long introduction is just to kill time waiting until we will have a presentation on the screen. Yesterday, in preparation for this session on IPv6, I send you a couple of documents related to ITU Council meeting, upcoming ITU Council meeting. I hope you had the time to read them through, and if you have any questions related to those documents, please feel free to ask experts in addressing who are present in this room, and will be briefing us on these issues. So I will turn mic to Axel. To you, maybe you can introduce your colleagues, and we have about depending on number of questions, something between 30 and 45 minutes.
Lovely, thank you very much, Yanis. My name is Axel Pavlik. I'm the managing director of the RIPE NCC, as you probably know. To my right is Paul Wilson, the Director General of APNIC, and one step further is John Curran, President and CEO of ARIN, and we have to send the regards from Raoul and from Adiel from LACNIC and AFRINIC, respectively. We also have some board members and some staff members from the RERs in the room. Right, just on time, very good. I have brought the regular statistics presentation from the NRO, basically about the number of resources and the status of allocation there. I don't know if we want to spend lots of time on that. You've seen this before, and I do have to apologize. This is June's version. We do updates here on a quarterly basis, so the October version is about to be out, and I'll send it off to Yanis as soon as I have it. All right. There it is. Good. IPv4, you have heard about it. We're running out of IPv4 address space. That hasn't changed. The slide says there are 30/8s left at IANA for allocation. That by now is down to 26. And you see the allocation to the RERs. Just gone. That's the address space issued by the RERs to our members. And you see that halfway through 2009, it looks as it would more or less be very similar to 2008. So no specific news here, really. It's going on to be allocated, and to be used. The runout of IPv4 aerospace currently stands, or is estimated at IANA runout late 2011, and the RARs probably will run out early 2013, I think somewhere in February. But of course, those numbers are going to change as things develop. Okay, so that overall in /8s, RARs to our members over the last 10 years, you see that, well, as last time more or less, Aaron and the RIPE NCC and APNIC have allocated the bulk of the IPv4 aerospace to their regions, and LACNIC and AFRINIC are slowly growing and have done, AFRINIC not quite in a /8 yet, and LACNIC about 3.5, the half time of the year. Next. ASN assignments, basically it's more or less the same story here. Again, here we see that RIPE NCC and Aaron have done the bulk of the allocations there, and assignments and APNIC, AFRINIC and LACNIC are lagging behind a little bit. IPv6 aerospace, you know that one format prefix, 1/3, has been made available by the IETF to IANA for allocations. That's the global unicast, the yellow big ring that is currently in use. You see the multicolored ring in the bottom that are various allocations to the RARs prior to the October 2006, when the RARs all got a rather large /12 prefix for further allocation. That is to say, then all the regions, all the RARs regions in the world, have roughly the same amount of address space available for allocations based on needs by the members. Also, here the RIPE NCC, you see the yellow spikes. There is quite a lot of, well, there is some demand. It's not comparable really with IPv4, but you see within the IPv6 world there is quite a spike in 2008, 2009. Will be of course higher than 2008 already. So that is an indication for the fact that there is awareness out there, that the operators are aware of the fact that they should think of IPv6, and they do think of it, and they do request address space. You see a certain increase there, and that's also backed up by studies that we have done, or that the EU has done, actually, in various of our regions. Basically, the situation there is the same, more or less around the globe. People know of IPv6, they know they should be doing it, and they will do it next week, more or less. So they request address space, and we don't see much of it being actually in use on the internet, but apparently somebody is thinking and somebody is starting to prepare to play with it in case they need it next week. Next. So overall, the allocations from the RARs over the last also 10 years, you see in total allocations on the left side, and overall, yeah, in minimum allocation space of /23s on the right-hand side. The pictures are roughly similar. RIPE NCC is RIPE NCC service region is leading there, closely followed by APNIC and ARIN. And AFRINIC and LACNIC are also doing allocations there. And you don't really see them that well on the right-hand side because they are relatively small, but that was to be expected maybe. You know, our statistics and other raw data is available on various websites and on the NRO statistics page. As I said, the new set will be coming out within the next couple of days, I hope, and I'll alert you to the fact that they are out. But overall, I don't expect the picture to change significantly. Same as we said last time, IPv6 run out, yes, IPv4 run out, IPv6 is being picked up, but slowly. If you have any questions, we are welcome. We are here. We are happy to reply to them.
So thank you, Axel. Now time for questions. Italy, Stefano.
Hi. How much is the evaluation you have about the the users being aware? And I'm asking this because at least some of the research networks in Italy, but not only in Italy, there is a transition to IPv6 addresses that is made completely transparent. The user do not realize that. But this is a good move, I think, because little by little this will happen without even a specific pressure of the users. I would like you to elaborate a little bit about that.
The end user, I think, is not very aware of the fact that there are addresses like that at all, V4 or V6. So it doesn't make much of a difference to the end user. We know that's part of the problem also, that there is not much of a market push there. I do know that at least one person in this room has a native IPv6 connection at home. But again, there have been increasing numbers of presentations, for instance, at RIPE meetings about the issues that the ISPs face in getting customer premises equipment out to the end users that are capable and willing to run IPv6 properly. The fact that there are those presentations and that there is exchange about that is a good sign. But again, the end user probably couldn't care less in the most cases. There are, of course, early adopters who want it because they want to brag to their friends, who then scratch their heads and say, what? If my colleagues maybe want to...
Stefano, there is one whole area of statistics that's not reported in this address status report, and that's to do with the actual operational status of IPv6 in the internet. And there are numerous researchers who are reporting on both routing of IPv6 in the internet and the traffic volumes of IPv6, and not only the volumes but the source and type of traffic. And in fact, there's a lot of what you'd call clandestine IPv6 traffic that is coming through things like peer-to-peer software, and that software is typically updated, like a lot of software is these days, automatically when software updates are available. So it was quite surprising when one of the major ISPs was able to reveal that a large proportion of traffic was absolutely unknown to the user. Not that the use was unknown, but the fact that their software that they were using had updated itself and was running V6. And in the case of peer-to-peer software, it was being used to, as that software does, to negotiate the best and the fastest peer-to-peer connections that are available. And IPv6 was actually automatically the choice of that software for carrying out its data transfer.
If I could also pick up
the question of user demand for IPv6 is a question which is rather interesting. I think there's an enormous user demand for the internet, and in about 3 years, ISPs will not successfully be able to grow their services without using V6. There's some workarounds possible using V4. Those will work a short time. It's a question of how many months or years you get out of them, but you're not going to get very far. So 100% of the users want internet service, and what they're saying is they want it, whether it's V4 or V6, I think that it's early to ask the users about their need for it. It's probably appropriate to ask the ISP community whether they need V6, because that's where the realization is really happening right now in the community. The ISP community is waking up and realizing that they can't continue to offer services unless they begin doing it over V6.
So thank you, Paul and John. Australia, Brenton.
Thanks, Janice. I must say I sort of endorse the view that users don't really care what they're getting, that they're basically just want an address name. It's been put to us in Australia, probably by Jeff Houston, I think, probably as strong as anyone else, that the market's going to sort itself out on this, that as we run out of IPv4, prices are going to increase there, and that people will be driven towards an IPv6 outcome. and ultimately users won't care providing they've got the connectivity. And on the question of connectivity, we've done a number of discussions with banks and various other industry users, and from our understanding, they're pretty well prepared for the changes they need to make to their equipment. They're putting in their upgrades to their equipment, IPv6 available, twin stack type arrangements that are looking pretty good, and we've got government actually moving along on a pretty tight time frame in Australia as well. So I have to say, overall, I'm feeling fairly relaxed about this. It's sort of what sounded originally like Y2K before Y2K is now sounding like Y2K after Y2K. So I'm sort of wondering what crisis here. Am I being too relaxed about this?
If I may comment, I don't think a lot of people feel relaxed about it. So perhaps you're more calm than called for. It is true, though, that this is not an insurmountable task. It's a process. I have the background of having run two nationwide carriers and one hosting company. And the ability to plan now and incorporate V6 in your normal investment curve and in your normal upgrade infrastructure means when you need it, you'll have the equipment and the skill set. The folks who put it off until they hear the consumer ask for it, for example, which they may never hear, or the folks who decide that it is a laissez-faire approach is 100% called for and decide that that means even awareness isn't necessary, will find themselves with a lot of other organizations all at the last minute looking for equipment upgrades, expertise, and similar. So to some extent, the ability to create awareness in the community so that they can be prepared for this, particularly in the business community, the ISP community, hosting, is crucial because it makes this bump that we're going to go through tolerable. I don't know if it makes it calm, but it makes it a reasonable effort to plan for.
One of the questions that the Australian government could calmly ask itself is for instance, whether it's taking the very straightforward steps in preparing for IPv6 by, for instance, in the NBN, the National Broadband Network Initiative in Australia. Is it being planned to deploy IPv6 or have that network IPv6 ready from the start? Okay, it would be a major mistake if it's not, but that's a sort of mistake that's being could be occurring on all levels, from national networks to small customer networks, as upgrades and deployments are being done over the next year. Because anyone who doesn't think about IPv6 now is just looking at more cost and expense a few years down the track. And again, that's not a disaster. It's not something to get overly concerned about, but it is something that needs some planning and awareness, and that's the process that we're very engaged in at the moment.
So thank you, European Commission, Michael.
Axel, you showed the graph there where we find a rather globally unequal distribution of the rollout of all the distribution of the IP version 6 addresses at the moment, with two regions clearly in the lead. Is there a reason for concern about this imbalance right now? Because some of these regions might need IPv6 to run dual stack, and also in the future for availability. Thank you.
No, there's no reason for concern here. Basically, we have been allocating and are still continuing with this according to need and to number of allocations and the requests for allocations that do come in. So apparently it's Aaron and the RIPE NCC who get the most requests currently, and APNIC closely, I think, following there. The rest of the world is just a bit slower. Now, you are aware of the fact that there is plentiful IPv6 address space, and there is still currently enough IPv4 address space to allocate according to need and to fulfill requests that are coming in, and that'll be the case for the next probably 2 to 3 years. So, no, V6, there's plenty of that available, and we expect more requests coming in also from the other regions. It's just that they are a bit slower in the pickup.
Thank you again, Commission Bill.
Thank you. I just wondered, as we enter the end game for IPv4, is there any evidence so far of hoarding or inappropriate or unjustified requests for allocations that you've had to deny because you don't feel they're justified? You think people are trying to hoard?
Yeah. So in the Aran region, we sort of in preparation for this established a set of policies and practices for validating new address requests. This includes requests for addresses from entities actually requiring legal corporate attestation to the application. So it is not your network engineer sending off a message saying, I'd like some addresses. An officer of the company literally has to say, this application, which documents our need, is valid. We've done this in advance to head off potentially a chance of hoarding. So with that step in place, we have seen some applications that have come in, which when we've said you now have to legally attest to them, have said that's a process for us to do, we'll get back to you. And that's perfectly reasonable. I would not at this point say it's a high risk activity because of the steps we've put in place, at least in this region.
I think all of the RARs in some form or other are paying close attention and closer attention, I think, if only to make sure that we're being seen to be doing the right thing. And at APNEC, we've got an escalation process for large requests that get dealt with in a deliberately more thorough way. One of the interesting things about one of the charts that Axel showed before is that we're not seeing any land rush at all on IPv4 address space at the moment. In fact, over the last year, the IPv4 address space consumption has dropped in most regions, or at least decelerated across the world. And we've seen, if you track IP address allocation over the years, it actually tracks very closely to economic circumstances. So you'd expect at the moment, things are slowing down rather than us seeing any of the predicted land rush behaviour that has been feared for the last several years.
Thank you, Paul. UK, Mark.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I thought it was an interesting comment about ISPs in 3 years' time, as they contemplate growing their services, that will be a kind of trigger point or crunch point for them. And that seems to be like the first such trigger in the market, so to speak. And it would also coincide possibly with the introduction of new GTLDs and internationalized domain names. So I thought that was an interesting comment. I don't know whether you think that will be the time when this whole process of migration starts to be less haphazard, less ad hoc, and whether you think, is there any kind of role for governments in that? Your point about national strategies is well taken. I think the UK would look to an orderly migration in order to ensure our Digital Britain strategy isn't derailed or underachieving as a result of the failure to migrate in the UK internet community. And so I guess a further question there is whether you think governments should have a role in identifying the essential parts of the national internet, if it's possible to talk in those terms, which should help that orderly migration. What would you advise in terms of identifying those essential elements rather than just seeing what happens in the market? Thanks.
I'll respond first. I think the other panelists might want to. It's actually a very simple situation. Governments are a major user themselves of IT technology. They have their own strategy for how they do that, and they can show leadership by taking their public-facing websites, the websites that address their citizenry, and making them IPv4 and IPv6 reachable, both. That's not a hard task to do, but it will serve as a leadership move. It will make sure that when customers are connected via V6, they have direct, unfettered access to government resources. It will show demand to the ISP community that this is services they need to provide by providing IPv6 hosting and transport. So the simple task is not to worry about planning the ISP transitions. I think a lot of carriers and ISPs would tell you, thank you, we actually don't want your assistance in the planning realm. But in simply to get your own house in order and prepared by making it IPv4 and IPv6 reachable. That one task, if everyone did globally, we would not be discussing transition, since all resources would be V6 reachable. But if just the governments did it for their own infrastructure, that would be a wonderful leadership move.
The other government action, of course, is in procurement and making sure that right now any procurement for IT infrastructure services equipment specifies that IPv6 compliance needs to be stipulated, explained, documented. IPv6 compliance is something that that is fairly well understood in terms of what any particular piece of equipment needs to do. It's a fairly broad term in terms of the internet more broadly, but for equipment procurement, for services procurement, for connectivity, IPv6 should be on the must-have list right now, because again, it's one of those things that if it's not, then very quickly down the track, it's upgrades and further expenses needed, and there's almost no excuse for that, I think, at this stage, given what we know. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. So the follow-up question? UK.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Just a quick follow-up. What about the position of IPv6 transition vis-à-vis introduction of new GTLDs? Is there any comment on that you'd like to make to us? Thanks.
No comment. New Zealand, Frank?
Yeah, just a comment on what Paul said. We've initiated a IPv6 steering group in New Zealand to try and move ourselves forward, and we had a very, very successful series of meetings around looking at the issues that people saw with IPv6. What emerged overwhelmingly was the need for training for network engineers. Probably most universities, for example, in their training of new computer scientists have yet to take seriously the need to train those people in IPv6. Similarly, existing network engineers tend to cling to existing skill sets, which are based on IPv4. And so there's some reluctance on the part of the industry to move because they're protecting an existing skills base rather than recognising the need to expand that. I'm just wondering if there's anything that the RIRs are contemplating doing to look at the training issue, because that is actually the third issue that governments need to be looking at. Thank you.
Yes, I can start on that. The RIPE NCC has started doing, on a relatively lightweight scale, some IPv6 trainings. We have been hearing that from some parts of our community as well. Now we are fully aware of the fact that there are plenty of people out there doing courses commercially, so we don't want to interfere with them. However, we have been told to do some of this, and we did, and those training courses proved to be quite popular and will make e-learning modules available online as well about them. The other thing that's not that much training but more advocacy is a website that we have been setting up, ipv6actnow.org, that basically tells about experiences other people have made. So it's not training as such, but advocacy in the wider sense, awareness raising. That's what the NCC has been doing.
In the Aran region, we are actively working with the many educational institutions. There's an association in that area, Educom and Internet 2, working on the next generation in the educational community. And we've been working on them, working on their own infrastructure, plus their educational curriculum, which they're doing to revamp that. We've highlighted the need for that. Additionally, outside, we've done in the Caribbean portion of our region work with the folks down there to ensure that there's ICT communications education training for some of the economies in that region. So we intend to do more outreach and more facilitating educational materials, because I do believe the training issue is very significant.
I don't think it's well recognized, actually, that training has been a huge priority of the technical community for 20 years, that organizations like ISOC, like the RIRs, like the network operators groups that exist nationally and regionally around the world have been training technicians for years and years and years. And it's precisely because the training of a technician in internet technologies doesn't depend on what happened a few years ago when the courses were written. It depends on what's happening now, this year, and what's about to happen. And academic institutions, frankly, haven't been able to keep up that well. So particularly, I think, in a developing region like the APNIC region, we see one of the absolute primary challenges being accessibility of human resources to build networks and to keep them running securely and efficiently. You know, the difference in security and efficiency, cost efficiency between a network that's well run and a network that's badly run is huge. So this is something that has been a priority for years. IPv6 has come along as now a major training demand in the Asia Pacific. I know, and it's something that we've been rolling out for quite some time now. We've also been aware, though, that we have to go out through institutions to make sure that the right stuff is being taught, because but that also has been an ongoing challenge for quite some time. And teaching outdated technical material and information in many universities actually is something we've seen for quite some time. So it's an ongoing challenge and one that's ramping up at the moment.
Thank you. Netherlands, Thomas.
Thank you, Chair. One thing mentioning, I think in line also what Frank Marsh from New Zealand told, asked about the training aspects of IPv6. In the Netherlands, the same company who did the root scalability survey for ICANN, TNO, the scientific research organization, also set up a kind of test bed for IPv6. And it's not the solution, but I think it's one of the many tools you can use to, let's say, to smoothen the transition. I think in this case, the TNO focused more on the small and medium enterprises, which are probably not the first introducers, but it helps also. So, let's say, companies with not so much engineering capacity can go there and test their IPv6 implementation. So probably other countries have the same, but it's worth mentioning also. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Malta, Joseph.
Yeah, thanks very much, Chair. In Miriam Malta, we have really followed a similar course to New Zealand. We'd set up a steering group as well as a lab facility in order to try and get a sense about the implications of this, costs and what have you. And we have the makings of a strategy in this. And it's also because it's a small place, I think there's a recognition that government has to lead always in this very big case. I think that, you know, what has stumped us is that there isn't the incentive to make the transition, and we don't want to be the first to make the move. And this is, you know, where we're looking possibly if there were some guidelines relating to this, there was some plan that is coming from ICANN, but this is where we feel that we're stopped. I think that we're fairly well prepared to make the transition, but we're hesitating to make that move.
Comment. I think there's two different transitions that people need to think about. And one is manageable and potentially an area where everyone can act unilaterally and end up with a net common good, and one is much harder. The first transition is looking at what's on the public-facing internet. Truly, it's for ICANN, it's the ICANN website. For the RIRs, it's our services and our website. For governments, it's your websites predominantly, mail servers and websites. Right now, you can transition those to be on IPv4 and IPv6, both, without coordinating with anyone, without worrying about impact. And that's what many of us have done. Many of the public websites used to be a fraction of a percent. Now it looks to be about 2% are both IPv4 and IPv6 enabled. So that transition is something that I think everyone can do completely independently in their own economy for the benefit of the internet. And it does not have an impact, and it's a very small amount of your IT infrastructure is actually the portion which is publicly facing. The second transition is the one that a lot of organizations get concerned about, which is much more difficult, which is how do I make my national networks, my internal infrastructure, IPv6 enabled? That's an area where it's much more complicated and much more difficult, but it's not necessary for that second transition to occur for the internet to have moved to IPv6. If we move the public resources, the internet has moved to IPv6.
Thank you, John. Denmark?
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to share that in Denmark we have an action plan on introducing IPv6. It's a public-private partnership. And also in the public procurement, we have put in a requirement for IPv6 into the IT systems. Yep.
Thank you, Julia. I would like to ask your question related to the documents I have sent yesterday to the GAC mailing list, and you certainly are aware of them. And I'm referring to the document report by Secretary General of ITU on IPv address allocation and encouraging development of IPv6, which is prepared for ITU Council meeting, which is taking place tomorrow and day after tomorrow in Geneva. And in this particular document, at the end, where is the recommendations, Secretary General of ITU recommends that the further studies of possibility for ITU to become another internet registry. And propose policies and procedures for ITU to manage a reserved IPv6 block. How would you like to comment from your perspective whether that is a clever move or whether that will bring benefit for developing countries as it is suggested in the document, or that is not overly clever move? And it is important, in my view, for us to understand this position, because ITU sometimes is perceived as a secretariat, ITU secretariat, but in reality that is, these are ITU member states, including those member states who are sitting around this table. And for us it is important to understand what, where is the danger, if there is one, or where is the benefit, if there is one, that we can liaise with those people who are sitting in ITU and try to explain them, or whether raise their hands in favor or against.
That is an interesting document, isn't it? Yes, we are, of course, aware of the fact for a couple of years that there are ideas like this around from the ITU. Now, this has taken on some considerably more formal form. I seem to understand that this is based on the understanding that there are some issues with allocations of address space to some developing countries. And I've frankly, in Geneva, I've asked Malcolm Johnson, the director of ITUT, what those problems were. And he said, oh, no, but there are no problems. I said, oh, wait, solved, right? Thank you. But apparently there is the understanding by some member states that a reservation of address space, IPv6 address space, would be beneficial for later on when we are running out of V6 address space and some countries didn't get their share yet. Personally, I think that that's unbased. There's so much V6 space out there. On the other hand, I don't know what to do about this. As you've seen in the paper, I've talked to him and said, well, you know, the RARs, policy development processes, are open for anybody and everybody, and if some member states of the ITU or the ITU secretariat perceives the need to do something about this, as various resolutions say they should study address allocation, then you're more than welcome to come to our PDP processes or develop draft policies and put them into that process, and then we see where that goes. So far, we are open to that. I don't think that this is really needed. I'm absolutely not sure that it would be beneficial to the Internet to have a parallel allocation forum and a setup there. I don't know what this will be doing to the routing on the Internet. Whether that is beneficial, I very strongly doubt. But I see Paul getting ready.
I think it's fair to say that we're all very mystified by the real basis for this proposal. It's said that there are developing countries who have problems receiving IP address space, but I think, as you all know, there is no case, and there can be no case, of a country with a shortage of IP address space. IP address space is allocated where it's needed, when it's needed, regardless of the country. There is no rationing, there is no country-based division whatsoever. So to say that there's a shortage or a difficulty on a country basis is to talk about something else that's going on. There's certainly cases, for instance, with where there may be a less than competitive, open competitive regime where dominant ISPs make it very difficult for smaller ISPs to grow at all and therefore seriously constrain the demand for IP address space, but that reflects the serious constraint on any competitive network growth at all, and that sort of situation certainly exists, but I think everyone would agree it's beyond the purview of RIRs. As to the effects of a parallel allocation scheme, I think that's also something that is of great concern. I have heard it said often enough that the intention and the desire is for a certain country to have its own address space to manage as it wishes to manage it, which is clearly an understandable desire. But it's got to be recognised that the Internet exists as a single, globally cohesive, end-to-end network or network of networks because of a common address management framework. We have five RIRs, but the five RIRs coordinate really very closely, mostly through the communities themselves and through structures like the ASO and the Address Council, to make sure that we do have cohesion in national, in the regional policy frameworks.
that will become much, much more difficult at a national level, particularly with assertions of independence and so forth. And I think it's absolutely inevitable that there's a fragmentation of the internet along the lines of those national allocation pools because of the, I'd say, impossible task of coordinating a cohesive global framework for addressing that will allow the cohesion of the global network to actually be maintained. So I have to say that from my point of view, there seems to be a very serious risk from the implementation of a scheme like this.
I'd like to pick up on what Paul said and make it very plain. Successful internet operations today is dependent upon the activities of the largest ISPs and carriers globally, which have to carry, unlike in a telephony world, have to carry routing for every possible internet destination in every backbone router that they have. This is a very different world than the class 5, class 4 phone switch world. Every router requires every route. And what this means is that because we assign addresses through the RIR system and we assign a single block to a multinational backbone, an organization that might serve a portion of a continent or an entire continent or multiple continents, that all ends up aggregating to one route for that one block, unless the carrier wants to divide it for his traffic purposes. So the internet routing table and the internet architecture that we know how to keep running is predicated upon a hierarchical address plan anchored at the internet provider at the top. We literally do not know technically how to keep the internet operational if a multinational is told to use address space from multiple countries and where it might have had one set of routes to have to instead carry 100 times or 180 times those number of routes. So this is a situation that we're at the early part of a process that we need to be very careful about, because it is possible for us to irrevocably break the network if we don't keep the addressing plan in line with the routing plan.
Italy, Stefano.
Okay, when we knew about this request, then it was not a surprise, the fact simply that there is an organization that proposes to add a new RIR. But the surprise is ITU, with the logics of ITU, because this is connected to prehistory of the telephones. And so the real point, and then the idea that each state has a block and then replicate the model of the telephones. And what is worrying then is also if this proposal goes on, then how about the security and stability? Because certainly a number of discrepancies, a number of possible ambiguities comes out. And so I think that when you presented the proposal, someone of you said, maybe Axel, that they should at least making a convincing proposal that assures that there will be no harm in security and stability, and we doubt strongly that. Perhaps this is the message that we should convey to our partners that are going to ITU. And Jeff Houston has been mentioned several times. He made a good report concerning the proposal that was made back in 2004 by Mr. Hulin Zhao. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
let me clarify. There are different aspects to this paper and this proposal. The one that I've discussed with Malcolm Johnson was about the reservation of outer space for the need of developing nations later on. And we didn't go into much detail there. I assumed, and I discussed that with him, that those allocations from that outer space at some point in time, 50 years on maybe, would be made by the RIRs if they still exist then. The other proposal or the other idea is indeed of actual allocation by ITU in a parallel allocation structure. That is something that I certainly do not support.
I think the issue of security and stability is on the internet is absolutely tied to the issue of complexity, and there's no doubt that the complexity of the internet increases very dramatically with this kind of additional with the constraints, for instance, that John Curran described. But one of the other factors there that I don't think is well recognised is that we know that the internet routing tables, currently 300,000 or so, are continuing to grow. There's speculation that it's not really well tested, but we could go to 1 million or 2 million routes on the internet without any problem. And that's certainly true, but what you need to understand is that in order to achieve that, you're talking about a router that doesn't sit on a table. That's a router that sits in a big rack and costs millions of dollars and is not a green machine by any stretch. It's a major piece of equipment, which is very different from the requirements today. So the fact is, as John mentioned, that everyone who wants to be connected to the internet as a peer ISP into that global network needs routers of that kind. And if you're accelerating the requirements on your basic internet service provider infrastructure from what might currently be $10,000 or $100,000 machines up to multi-million-dollar machines in every corner of the internet in order to be properly connected to the internet, then there's clearly a huge digital divide potential there, which is also really unexplored. And to say that there's a developing country advantage to this proposal when in fact there's that kind of threat and risk looming is really strange.
So I will take three more comments from the GAC side. So Heather, Thomas and Brenton in that order, and I think that then we should wrap up this session. Heather, please.
Thank you. For those that don't know me, I'm the Canadian GAC representative. I will be brief. I just wanted to express appreciation for your efforts today in providing information about the nature of the internet, the role of version 4 and version 6, and putting it into a framework of really what is best for the internet and these issues that we really need to think carefully about in making decisions around, you know, governance arrangements and this sort of thing. Seems to me it's really important that we seek fact and good information in order to advance these discussions. Otherwise, it's simply not possible. And so I really welcome the efforts of the RIRs to provide us with this information so that governments can be better informed around the nature of the role and that you perform and where it fits in and how it impacts the internet, most importantly. I also note that the Internet Society has been developing materials, I think, that are useful, particularly for policymakers, because they're looking at it from a policy perspective, and have, a degree of removal from the RIR system that I think is also useful in informing us. So, thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Thomas.
thank you, Chair. Just one comment on the, let's say, the ITU paper. I think we are not a forum to judge this, of course. This is something which has to be dealt with the member states and the associated parties. One thing which I would say from the Dutch point of view is that we were not, let's say, content with the way it's proposed. I think Very much I echo what Axel said. I think first you have to really assess the real problems, if there are, and then you can talk about alternative models. And you have to get first at possibly or possible problems there. And then again, I think I, from the Dutch point of view, we very much endorsed the self-regulatory system, which now is in place. It's a sound system. It's been recognized in the WISIS. There are many, let's say, factors and arguments which plea for the existing system. So, in principle, the Dutch position is that whenever there's a problem, it should first be solved within this self-regulatory system. And if not, then, of course, you can think about other things. Thank you.
Thank you. Brenton.
And I'll be brief as well. Just picking up again on the ITU issue, I'd just like to endorse Thomas's comments. It's still an active discussion within the ITU. We shouldn't consider it a fait accompli. But I think your comments before about the coordination issue are extremely valuable. And I was just wondering whether you've actually published those comments, had some interaction with the ITU, or there's some reference point that we might be able to draw on for those of us that are involved in the ITU process. I think what you were saying before is extremely valuable information as to how we might set our positions within government. Thank you.
I think we're very interested in collaborating and cooperating with those who are interested in the issues, and I think we're very wary of launching headlong into a dispute in an arena that we're not experts in by any means. So I think the process that we're in right at this moment is one of hopefully sharing information with those who may be more qualified and more sophisticated in how you could deal with the situation in your arenas. But I think we're at the moment preparing for publications of various kinds to address the factual issues, as we've heard before, in particular, and to explain in as rational and objective a manner what the considerations and implications of this thing is. But if it's according to the scenarios and the way things may pan out, it really is quite a complex set of documentation and information. Thanks.
So thank you. I think, dear friends, this latest part of the discussion is very revealing, and I think it would be our duty to get in touch with those people who will be traveling tomorrow or participating tomorrow and day after tomorrow in the council meeting, and to give them information we received today. And if I would like to draw your attention to one document I sent to GACList, which is named ICANN RER IPv6 Fact Sheet, dated 09/10/21, and at the beginning, the first sentence of this document says, a factual paper prepared for and endorsed by the CEO of ICANN and all the regional internet registries, October 2009. I think that is a four pager description of problem and argumentation of RERs in this respect. So I would like to encourage those who want to do that, please forward that document. That will be helpful for delegates in ITU to better understand the complexity, and hopefully they will be able to find a compromise solution which would not harm internet at the end. So by saying this, I would like to thank Axel, Paul and John for entertaining us. It's usually very interesting and informative. Thank you very much indeed. And see you in one of our next meetings.
Our pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Now I would like to continue our session with a discussion on the proposed changes in the bylaws, particularly Article 9, elections of the chair and vice chair. You have hard copies of the document in front of you. The proposal has been distributed to the GAC mailing list about 3 months ago and received no comments but one from European Commission. And I think that all or almost all your proposals, Bill, have been taken into account. And I would like to see now whether we are in a position to have a quick read of the document, paragraph by paragraph, and then adopt. Bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for taking most of my comments into account. I still have one issue that I'd just like to share with colleagues. It's an issue I've raised before, actually, and it's about the implications of having effectively a secret ballot or a ballot in a box where the organization of that ballot is made by the GAC Secretariat, given the future possibility that the GAC Secretariat would be provided by ICANN staff. It's not a major concern of mine, but it seems a bit odd, actually, that we would rely on ICANN to determine the validity of the vote, actually, and that no GAC officers would be responsible for that. I think I've mentioned it before. I didn't actually hear anyone strongly arguing for a secret ballot, I have to say, in the various discussions that we've had. I didn't hear anybody objecting to a show of hands for candidates. I've mentioned before that I think that would be in keeping with our request to ICANN to become a more transparent organization, that there's a certain irony that we've then moved to secret ballots when, in fact, we've never had an election in the GAC. We normally elect our chair and vice chairs by consensus, which I think is a system that's worked so well. But the fact we haven't had an election means we haven't had any problems with the current procedure, which would be a show of hands amongst members, if necessary, if there are more than one candidate. Now, I don't particularly want to cause a major problem over it. I'm just aware that when this has been discussed before, nobody has asked for a secret ballot. And given the implications of the current proposal, that it would be ICANN staff who would supervise that. So, to be blunt, we could end up in a situation where we're not sure who's voted for who, but the ICANN staff will tell us who's actually been elected as our chair. I have certain reservations about that still. And given that we haven't had an extensive discussion on this before, I'd very much welcome the views of other colleagues, whether they have any objections if we continue to proceed in a manner where we would elect our chair by either acclamation or a show of hands. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. I think until now the discussion have been on this issue has taken place between us, and I am adamantly opposing election of the chair in case of competitive election of chair by showing hands. This is this has never been a tradition in any organization, in any, including I don't know, there are no voting in European Commission, but in any organization which competitively elects any chairperson, that would take place by showing hands. That means that person who is elected subconsciously will be harming those who would vote against him. So that's the human nature. And I'm not sure that the mere fact that we should that we never had competitive elections in the GAC should lead us to change centuries old traditions. So, and I'm adamantly opposed that. Austria.
Thank you, Yanis. I heard what Bill just said, and I can understand his concerns, and I somehow share the concerns. Because what we are not, and I understand your arguments, Yanis, but what we are not is an international organization, as the ITU, as any other organization is. So the GAC and ICANN is carried on a more formal, informal basis. So I think there is room enough for elections of show of hands, though I understand your arguments. But if we say we have a secret votes, then I miss something procedural here in the provisions. For example, maybe I'm wrong, but for example, we had to define a minimum quorum of people present, of people voting. Because as the text stands here, a vote would be valid if only two people were voting. So if we want to have it that formal that we have secret votes, then we should make a really clear procedure in a legal form. And I'm missing that here.
The formulation which is provided is very, very soft and says if there is a need. So until now, there hasn't been a need. I'm not sure that we need enter into legal disputes, not legal disputes, but in legal formulations. In that case, we would need to rewrite all operating principles because they are not written by lawyers. So, and all of us, we know that we don't want to open operating principles for review as such. We agree that if we change something, then we change only one paragraph related to elections of officers, which formulations does not provide clarity when nomination starts, when nomination ends, that provides interpretation and so on. And the only purpose of this proposal is to clarify when we start process, when we end process, and how we do it. Austria.
Thank you. Sorry for taking the floor again. Maybe my thinking is spoiled, as being a lawyer, I always think in such terms. I think it would be enough if, well, we say the election, who has the majority is elected. What we can say is the election is valid if half of the GAC representatives are present or so. That's half a sentence. That's nothing very, really serious. And I think that's really, really important because my experience, and I've been in this business for quite a long time, in my experience, these are the simple questions who make it most complicated because usually if something goes not the way somebody wants, then one starts to discuss the procedural questions, and I think with half a sentence we could solve the whole problem.
I have no problem to add sentence that chairman or person is elected if half of the GAC members cast favorable votes. So it's no problem then. We may run up in the situation that we will never get elected officers if we cannot reach this threshold of 50%. But anyway, we can certainly add that sentence. There is no question about that. Bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to Austria. Actually, I hadn't picked that up, and I think in many ways that's a more substantive problem than the one I raised, actually. That is an absolute prerequisite that we have an indication of the quorum that's required for the election of the chair and the vice chairs of a government committee. Yes, so thank you very much, Austria. I just take slight issue with you when you say that this is a completely unprecedented idea that we would have a show of hands, because the GAC has had this for 11 years, Yanis. This is the procedure that's in the current operating principles. I have to say I'm still a bit mystified, actually, about why we're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist at the moment. We haven't had a vote. And finally, I'd point out, and I point out with some regret, actually, because I pointed this out, I think, in the Mexico meeting or perhaps the Cairo meeting, that if we're going to have a new text now with the addition of this, and I think this is essential, then the current operating principles require that it's circulated 45 days, there are certain provisions actually, before we can adopt the change. So we wouldn't be able to adopt the document at this meeting. Thank you.
Stefano?
I'm participating in some of other similar fora. Someone are connected to the Internet Society. And the problem is normally to find a candidate or to find candidates for the post that we have. So we are in a similar situation as in the GAC, where we never had to vote. But just in case we have to vote, the votes are secret, just for the reason that Yannis said, that in any case, the one that prevails will be elected, and there is no the possibility to count who voted against, who voted the other, of the other candidate, and so on. So this is more fair, to my opinion. And so for this reason, I'm in favor of keeping the proposal like it is. But I realize that in the end, we should raise a point where to find a majority here if we go in this way.
Thank you, Stefano. Frank?
I'm a little torn each way in terms of whether we have a show of hands or anonymous ballot. I don't see a problem with an anonymous ballot, personally. And it's entirely open to the GAC to select a scrutineer if there's a problem with ICANN staff doing the job, so I don't see that as being a problem either. I just point out that in terms of there is a quorum requirement, and so all of the statement needs to be a majority of those present, because we don't have a GAC meeting if we don't have a quorum, the quorum being one third of the current membership. Thank you. I'm indebted to Canada for pointing this out. Canada actually has a copy of the article, so it's very good.
The document under discussion has been posted to the GAC mailing list right after the Sydney meeting, about 120 days before, and comments or proposed amendments were not posted during 90 days after posting, but 2 weeks before the meeting, Jubil made substantive amendments. So, and now you're arguing that this has not been posted 45 days in advance. So I'm slightly puzzled for this comment.
Yes, well, you're probably not the only one. I'm quite puzzled by this procedure. I did make proposals for changes. They haven't all been taken into account, actually. And I certainly didn't propose a vote ballot box, actually. So that's a new text. My point was that we under the current operating principles, and I can find you the article if you want, if you give me 5 minutes, there is a procedure that the text to be adopted has to be circulated within a certain time frame, 45 days or 90 days or whatever. And we're now operating with a new text that was only circulated, I think, 2 weeks ago, as you said, and we have a proposal for another change. I was just pointing out that if at the end of this meeting we have agreement, that text would then need to be available for adoption at the next meeting. That's my understanding of the current operating principles in force today. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Australia, Brenton.
Thanks, Jonas. I'm not sure an argument that says this is the way we've always done it is a good argument as to what we need to do in the future. I think that GAC is changing. I think it's changing quite dramatically. I think it's growing quite rapidly. and it's inevitable as part of this process that we're going to have to put in a few more formal structures as part of this development. So I don't think we should be afraid of putting in place new arrangements into the future, and I don't think we should live entirely on the processes of the past. I think we need to come back to the actual principles that are involved in the actual issue of a secret ballot. I think we'd all recognise that, you know, secret ballots are basically standard practice in most of the democratic countries in the world. It's an absolute standard. I think we also have to recognise that it's actually quite widespread among most of the UN-based organisations. My understanding is that the ITU, the UPU, the United Nations Economic and Social Council, the World Health Assembly, and other UN-based organisations all put this in place. And then there was, I think, the question that perhaps we shouldn't be like these other international organisations, and that we should actually be different because we're part of ICANN. But my understanding is that secret ballots are also part of some ICANN bodies, including the GNSO and ALAC. So I think one of the questions we're going to have to face if we don't endorse this approach is not so much why we should change, but perhaps a question why you haven't changed what appears to be something like a standard and quite defensible practice in other places. We haven't had competitive voting in the past, but I don't think any of us would predict that we'd never have it in the future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Brent, and especially now when the role of the chair of the GAC is growing in importance, I may imagine that there might be some interest to carry on the duty. UK, Mark.
Thanks. Just briefly coming in on that last point and reflecting on the fact that the membership is steadily increasing, and we all hope that if we will go past the 100 mark, and as we all engage in outreach efforts to those governments that don't take part, it's in the hope that they will recognise the value of this committee and its procedures. I think I'm coming down on side of the argument that it's best to put in place a procedure for secret ballots, because we quite well entertain the prospect of competing nominations. And I think the argument you described, Chair, at the beginning of this discussion was a really valid and fair one. So I think I'm okay with the text as you've circulated it. I haven't consulted legal experts. I'm not a legal person. I probably have to do that. I note also the contribution that Austria has made to this discussion in terms of establishing a proper and respected quorum for a vote. Thanks.
Thank you, Portugal. Luis?
Well, I just would like to join my voice to the two last interventions in favor of introducing this possibility, because it's better to prevent a situation that might occur than then to handle it when it appears.
European Commission, Bill.
Thank you, and thank you for the comments of colleagues. I mean, one of the reasons I raised this is because we haven't actually discussed this before. That worried me a little bit, actually, that we'd have a substantive change to the operating principles without having a tour de table of views of members. And it's been illuminating. I would clarify that I'm not against changing the operating principles or against the GAC modernizing. One of my major concerns, and I think it was highlighted yesterday, actually, Yanis, when you yourself outlined with a lot of support from members, actually, the important need for the review panels to be completely transparent, for them to be video conferenced, for there to be full transparency in the spirit of the AOC and the organization we're part of. And I just thought it was a question of timing, actually. Is this really the right time when we're asking for full transparency from the rest of the ICANN organization, actually, to be taking a step which, at the moment, at this point in our history, appears to be unnecessary? But I'm not going to die in a ditch, as we say in English, on this. I wanted to have the discussion. I personally didn't understand why, out of all of the issues we could be dealing with at the moment, including other parts of the operating principles that seem rather archaic to me, referring to, you know, faxes and pigeon post and things like that, just why this was on the agenda, why there was a problem, I didn't understand, actually. Not sure I do still understand, but I'm glad we've had the discussion, and I take note of the comments of colleagues. Thank you very much.
I can clarify why this is on the discussion. I remember the difficulty we all of us faced 3 years ago when the current chair was elected. It was not clearly understood when process started, when process ended. Happily, we had one candidate, and nobody contested elections. I remember Cheryl drafting, together with Secretariat, the timetable of elections, and it was not so easy to agree. So that led me to think that maybe some clarification with a clear and understandable deadlines of beginning of voting or submission of candidates, end of submission, and so on, should be put in place. For the first time, I suggested this change in the run-up to the elections, re-elections of the chair a year ago. I didn't follow operating procedures outlined in operating principles, and some members objected this way of procedure, and I took this question off the I withdrew my proposal, saying that I would submit it for the next meeting. What I did, I submitted it right after Sydney meeting for comments, and no comments were received for a long time. Then you came in. And I still believe that it is necessary to clarify procedures for election of the chair, which is coming up. The next year is a re-election of the chair, and that's why it is, in my view, it is needed. This clarification is needed, that we understand when we start selection, when we end selection, how we vote, if there is a vote, or when we clap hands, if there is acclamation. So, and that's the only reason. It is for our benefit, not for others' benefit. It is just for our benefit to make sure how we elect our officers, and that there isn't any misinterpretation or possibility of interpretation in different directions. So that's the only reason, for our own benefit. So, any other interventions on this subject? I see none. European Commission.
Just a clarification, Yanis. Are we? Will there now be an amendment made to the text to include a provision for a quorum? If so, I just wonder whether I could also take the opportunity actually to follow up on a suggestion I think maybe made by New Zealand, that maybe we should decide on who should organise the voting when we actually have a vote, rather than specifying the GAC secretariat here. And that's merely a provision to take account of the fact there's a realistic possibility that the ICANN staff will be doing that in the future. And it seems to me it would be not difficult for us to decide when we have an election, actually, if what the situation is there, and who should organise the vote. Thank you.
I think in this situation, and for the sake of time, I don't see possibility to continue this discussion, and I think we should move this question for the next meeting. And in the meantime, I would like to invite members to make their substantive suggestions, including Austria, if you could, Christian, could formulate your proposal on quorum, if you could, Bill, formulate your proposal on tellers, or whatever you imagine should be doing counting and organizing, and we will take up this question during our next meeting in Nairobi. I don't see other possibility today. So thank you very much. I don't think that we have Teresa. Maybe we make a 10-minute break, and we resume at 10:40 with a presentation from the staff on ICANN's operational or strategic planning. And that discussion will be linked with the GAC work program for year 2010. 10 minutes break.